Please begin.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Abigail Rankin, and I represent appellant Breelyn Monet Jefferson. The case before you follows a feud between sisters and an angry lie that sent one of them to prison. There are two issues before you on appeal today. First, the district court erroneously admitted hearsay without an exception. This error requires reversal and remand. Second, that the district court, that the state failed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Ms. Jefferson was in fact the individual who pulled the trigger in this incident. This issue requires reversal. The hearsay issue starts with excited utterance and then moves into the residual exception, so I'll go in that order. The district court found that Ms. Breonna Jefferson, I'm going to start going with Breonna and Breelyn for confusion's sake. Breonna gave a statement in a police car shortly after this incident took place. Breonna is appellant's sister and the alleged victim here, one of the alleged victims. Breonna's statement was found to be admissible under excited utterance and the residual exception. The excited utterance, the district court found that she was excited by the event that had just taken place, the shooting. But in fact, Ms. Jefferson and the video, the video shows that Breonna was in fact excited about being placed in the back of a squad car, and then later about the imminent towing of her vehicle. The officer Kempe, who is the one whose squad she was in the back of, testified at the court trial, that Ms. Jefferson was in fact, Breonna was in fact excited about being put in the back of the squad car. When she gets in the back of the squad car, the first thing she's doing is complaining about the police, using expletives to refer to them, and she doesn't immediately get in the back of the squad car crying or screaming or saying, "My sister shot me." She's worried about the police. She's upset about being stopped at gunpoint.
Is it fair to say your point of contention on the excited utterance determination is based on whether it was related to just simply irritation at being detained or, as the court found, from the actual shooting?
Yes.
Is that fair?
So that
we're not,
fair
we don't have to worry about the other elements of it as far as moving forward, that it was a startling event. The shooting was a startling
Correct.
Event and so on.
Correct. That's fair to say. That's my contention.
If that's the case and the district court made such a determination, we review for an abuse of discretion. I feel as if we somewhat weighed into looking at the sequence of events and injecting our feelings on what was startling and prompting the discussion.
You don't need to inject your feelings, Your Honor, because the district court's finding was clearly erroneous. If you look at the video itself, it is readily apparent that Breonna was not excited about the shooting. She was excited primarily and exclusively about being stopped at gunpoint, placed in handcuffs, and put in the back of the squad car. And that continues throughout her statement, that with the expletives towards the police and being upset about that specifically, saying, "I'm the one in the back of the squad car." The very beginning of the recording starts, the recording uses timestamps rather than like a zero sequential type of ordering. The timestamp at approximately 8:35, 55-ish, is where the dialogue begins. The rest of it is Officer Kempe getting to the scene. And she begins just saying, making statements about the police that use expletives, saying that they're stupid, and so on and so forth. The other individual who's placed in the back of the squad car with her is asking her to calm down, and she says, "No, I won't calm down." And the officer kind of says, "It seems like you're angry." And she says, "I am angry. I'm very angry. I'm the one in the back of the squad car saying that I shot something." So she's obviously upset about that specifically. And if you continue on, the video readily shows that she's not upset about the shooting. At approximately 8:58 to about 9:03, Breonna and her sister, who's also in the car, Brandy, a third sister, are talking about just what's on their minds. Officer Kempe's wandered away, and they're just having a casual conversation. And Breonna is talking about how she bested her sister, how she whooped her, how she, used these uppercuts and got the better of her. And she worries about her car. She worries about the tow. She complains about being in the back of the squad. She worries about what might be found in her car. She's not sitting there concerned about being shot at.
I don't know that we can parse it out. I mean, to me, it seems we have a continuum of events. I mean, initially the outrage and irritation that she was suspected as the shooter, mm-hmm. and then the aftermath of what happened with the shooting. I mean, is the time frame what you rely on as far as differentiating the continuum of events?
No, I more rely on the language in the rule requiring the statement to relate to the startling condition specifically. And the startling condition used to justify the omission of the statement was the shooting, not the toe, not the arrest. So her utterance was excited. We don't question that. She was upset. She was frustrated. She was annoyed. But it wasn't about the startling condition, the statement that she later gave regarded. The residual exception was also used to allow the admission of this statement, and the district court erred in so doing as well. There are a number of factors that are considered when admitting these statements under the residual exception. It must be a statement about material fact. It was the identity of the shooter. It must be more probative than any other evidence, and the interest of justice must favor admission. And we look at that last factor by analyzing the totality of the circumstances. ORTLEP provides four potential considerations. One I'd like to focus on is whether the statement is against penal interest. The district court initially said this seems similar to Planton, which is a case about penal interest, but then says, I'm not really sure if there's a statement against penal interest. I can't really address that. So she doesn't really consider this factor. And the case is not, in fact, similar to Planton. The district court, you'll notice in the transcript, took a break after having this hearsay objection to consider Planton and ORTLEP and read those cases. But she still then goes on to confuse Planton's facts a little bit by saying that this case is similar. The facts in Planton were there was a couple that had been both giving statements. The female in the couple had given some statements that were negative for both her interest and her partner's, but primarily her partner's. And she had said that they were fighting, but that they were trying to reconcile. And that reconciliation, that desire to reconcile, was the factor that the court relied on there to find that the statement had indicia of trustworthiness. But here, there's no indication these sisters are trying to reconcile. They've been fighting for weeks. They've got past cases against each other. Even if they did testify that they were close, there's a shooting. There are repeated instances. There's an alleged burglary a couple weeks before this that's in the record. There are some alleged allegations of being maced prior to this as well. So these sisters are not getting along. There's no concern about the relationship between them informing Brianna's willingness to make this statement. If that were the case, if this were our typical recantation where one makes a statement and then realizes, oh, no, I don't want this to hurt my partner or my sister, what we would expect to see is they come into court and they testify to the exact opposite thing, where they say something a little bit less certain or a little bit more certain in favor of the defendant. But here, Ms. Brianna comes into court and she testifies hostily for everyone. She doesn't help the defense. She doesn't help the state. She says, I don't remember. I probably said that. I don't know. And she says, I probably said that, both to questions from the state and to questions from the defense. So this isn't our typical recantation situation. But she did recant the statement, which is another factor that can be considered under Griffin. You can also consider her character for honesty. She has numerous convictions for false statements to police. In the process of giving this statement, she lies midstream when she's talking or giving her final summation of what happened. She, at approximately 9:41:57, corrects herself. She says, my sister, my cousin, because the woman in the car with her had given a false identity of the cousin rather than the sister. So she's continuing, in the middle of recounting this version of events, to lie midstream, which shows that she's able to lie throughout this statement and makes her statement much less trustworthy. She also has, as I discussed, lots of motivation to lie here. She'd been in a feud. She'd just beaten her sister up. She's very excited about having just beaten her sister up, but she's throughout continuing to say, you know, I'm not going to stop beating my sister up. I'm going to keep doing this. So the statement itself, with all of these factors, is not trustworthy. It doesn't have our traditional indicia of trustworthiness. It doesn't have that guarantee. And that's what 807 and, frankly, 803 sub 3 look for, is that trustworthiness. They need the statement to be worth the same kind of testimony as it would be in court. And when the district court made this ruling, they hadn't heard the statement. The district court decided that this could come in under these exceptions without listening to the statement, without hearing the state's evidence. One of the other requirements of ORTLIP is that the evidence be consistent with evidence the state will present that strongly points towards the guilt of the accused. But here, the court says, I'm not sure what the evidence will be. They hadn't seen any testimony from Officer Kempe. They hadn't heard most of what the state was going to say happened that night.
This was a court trial.
This was a court trial, yes.
So even if we were to agree with you that this was improperly admitted evidence, why is that reversible error?
Because this statement is the only evidence in the record that points to Breland Jefferson as the shooter. The rest of the evidence in the record could just as easily be point towards Walter Davis, who was also there, and who Breonna Jefferson also accused multiple times of being the shooter.
What about the evidence of the T-shirt color and the T-shirt that was found?
The T-shirt is the only other potential evidence that could suggest that Breonna was the person. But again, Breonna and Breland had just engaged in an all-out drag-out fist fight in the parking lot. It makes sense that one might change a shirt or that one would own a black T-shirt and have it on their bed. That seems pretty minimal evidence to show that Breland actually committed this offense, just the fact that she owns a black T-shirt. There's no information that the black T-shirt had gunshot residue on it. There's no information that the T-shirt was worn specifically that day, perhaps that the officer had touched it and that it was warm because she had just changed out of it. There's none of that to show that here. It could just as easily be a black T-shirt on the bed. And because this statement is so powerful against my client, that the harm is very powerful here as well, the harm of its admission. I'll briefly touch on sufficiency as well. So even if we do ignore that statement entirely, because the district or the trial testimony entirely, the statement itself is insufficient to prove Breland Jefferson's guilt here. The statement waffles between Walter shot me, Breland shot me. Breonna initially identifies Walter. The officer says, who shot you? She says, Walter and Breland Jefferson. So Walter is her first reaction. Walter keeps coming up throughout as he shot, he had the gun, and then she corrects. There are statements like, he shot, the bullets came at the front of the car. Or he had the gun, well, he took it out of his pocket. He was chasing us down the alley, well, he got the gun back. There's all this statement that Walter had the gun and then an adjustment to correlate with the narrative that they've just come up with, apparently. The black T-shirt itself also doesn't exonerate Walter. Breland could have, again, been wearing that black T-shirt, taken it off. No indication that the shirt means that she was the shooter, just that she was there. And there's no argument that Breland was there and that Breland was around for this fight. There apparently videos of this fight, plenty of bystanders who saw both of them there and saw these events, none of whom testified, but they were there and they saw what happened. The statement ultimately, even if we ignore the trial testimony, the statement is not sufficiently credible to provide a sole basis, essentially, to convict my client.
Just looking back at the individuals who testified, so
yes.
Obviously Breonna did and was not found to be credible, and mm-hmm. then the officers did.
Yes.
Were there any other witnesses that the district court had?
No, it was, they had one 911 communications employee, but otherwise it was just officers who took statements. So really their testimony is based on what they received from Breonna and what they received from Breland. So that in and of itself is not enough to show that Breland was the shooter here. So the district court here did abuse its discretion by relying on facts that were not in the record or less supported than other facts in the record. Their decision to admit this statement was against logic and therefore was an abuse of discretion. The error was harmless. The statement's the only evidence that incriminates my client as the shooter. It was very persuasive. The district court relied on it throughout her opinion. This error must be reversed, and the issue or the case must be remanded to address what happens moving forward with this statement. In the alternative, there is insufficient evidence to show that Breland was in fact the shooter. The state failed to prove the identity of the shooter beyond a reasonable doubt. There's still reasonable doubt that Walter may have been the shooter as well. that error requires all-out reversal. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rankin. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, counsel. I am Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Peter Marker, representing respondent, State of Minnesota. I don't have a lot to add that's not in my brief, but I do have a few points I want to make, and of course answer whatever questions the court has. To be clear, and I think it's clear from our brief, but I want to be clear again here, it is not my position here, nor was it our position at trial, that the entire statement was an excited utterance. I think it starts out as an excited utterance. The statement is over an hour long in the back of the squad car that was admitted by Judge Osby. But the first part of it, and roughly the first 5 minutes of it, she's clearly under the aura of the excitement of the events, which certainly includes her being handcuffed and put in the back of the squad car, but clearly relates back to the shooting. And the car dying and the pushing of the car and it's all related. I'm not aware of any decision that parses out sort of the source of the excitement like appellant is suggesting this court do, especially here where there is a very tight timeline. The events are happening one after another. And so I would point the court and the trial court was not this precise, but it's certainly useful to look at the video with the transcript. I would point the court to the first identification by Brianna of who the shooter was, her sister, is at 3 minutes and 39 seconds on the video. She's still handcuffed. She's angry. She's just angry. I'm sure she's angry for many reasons, not the least of which is that her sister shot at her and riddled her car with bullets, endangering her life and the other occupants of the car. And without question, she's angry at the police for being suspected of criminal activity. The police didn't know what was going on at this point. And so she's excited. She admits at trial that what she said in the back of the squad car was under the heat of the moment or something like that. She admits that at trial. That is the definition of an excited utterance. It all relates back to the events that are happening. So at 3:39, she identifies her sister as the shooter. At 4:51 on the video, that's transcript to page 7, the officer, Officer Kemp, is convinced that these two are not suspects, but in fact they're victims. And he assures them that he basically says he thanks them for their understanding. We didn't know what was going on, we being the police, and you knew you were the victims, but we didn't. And so we had to figure that out. Let's take your handcuffs off, keep you warm in the back seat, and that things calm down after that. So after that point in time, and that's at about the 5.5-6 minute mark in the video, I think it's non-excited utterance after that. It certainly is, and so to the extent that it is appellant's argument that the state's taking the position that the whole thing was an excited utterance, that's just not my position. I mean, the first 6 minutes, I think, is an excited utterance, and it certainly was an abuse of discretion for Judge Osby to conclude that that was all related to the aura of the excitement of the events. And in that time period, she plainly identifies her sister as a shooter, plainly. There's the waffling argument is curious to me. I mean, she identifies her sister as a shooter initially and repeatedly throughout the squad car tape. So So the question is, as this court knows with respect, the question is not what might another trial court judge have done with that statement. The question is whether Judge Ospie abused her discretion in concluding that that was an excited utterance. And that decision was well within her discretion to make that conclusion. Now, and she specifically made it. I mean, she specifically said in her findings of fact on the verdict that Brianna made the statements while still under the aura of excitement of the events that had recently transpired, to the point where she was having an asthma attack, coughing, talking quickly. The statements made shortly after her new car had just been shot up, a startling condition for anyone, and all that related to that condition. That was the court's conclusion, and I think that is not reversible. Particularly, again, given Brianna's testimony at trial, that she herself was upset and in the heat of the moment when she was in the squad car. It's also my position, and I want to be clear, I made this point in the brief as well, that the entire statement is admissible under the residual exception. And so there's a little overlap between the part that's admissible under the excited utterance exception and the entire statement, which is admissible under the residual exception. It checks virtually all the boxes for the residual exception.
The one that seems most problematic is the statement against penal interest.
Well, Your Honor, we know from Planton, and this is what this court said in Planton, and you're referring to the third Ortlieb factor. And this court said the third Ortlieb factor may be satisfied even when a declarant's statement is not against the declarant's penal interest if the declarant is hostile to the state and supportive of the defendant. It is impossible it's difficult if you look at the video juxtaposed against her trial testimony to conclude, as Judge Ospie did, that she was plainly hostile to the state. She took the stand and said, you know, I don't remember. I was under the influence at the time. Nothing in that
video. Judge Ospie, if I recall, even made findings that in watching the video, there was no evidence of intoxication or slurred speech or whatever the word she used.
There isn't. I mean, if you look at the video, Brianna is articulate in her anger and very steadfast. And there's nothing even to remotely suggest that she's under the influence of anything. She's just mad at her sister, at the police, at the situation. So she takes a position at trial that is she says she doesn't remember what she said. That is Planton. That's what the declarant in Planton said. I don't remember. But in claiming she didn't remember, she was the only person that identified her sister as the shooter. In claiming that she didn't remember, she was plainly taking her sister's position. Or at least that is a reasonable inference. And I think that's the inference that Judge Ospie reasonably concluded, that, you know, and Judge Ospie allowed the prosecutor then to treat her as a hostile witness. And that decision is not at issue here, and nor should it be. I mean, that's a supportable decision by Judge Ospie, because as the prosecutor argued, outside of the presence of the witness, this was a court trial. The witness had taken a different position even that morning from what she's saying on the stand that was more consistent with her statement. So the third box of the Ortlieb test, to get back to your question, Your Honor, I think is checked given the Planton standard, because she's hostile to the state, and her testimony is supportive of the defendant. It also meets other, it also meets other factors. It's, there's obviously no confrontation problem. There's no dispute that the statement was made. The recording is quite clear. And her statements on the recording are quite clear. And it is consistent with other evidence of guilt. Now, the other evidence of guilt is the most important evidence of guilt, no question, is her statement. I mean, she identifies her sister as the shooter. And the other evidence of guilt is corroborative of that, but in and of itself, likely insufficient to establish that her sister was the shooter. So there's no question it's an important statement, critical to the state. And so the other point that I'd like to make, and I think I make it in the brief as well, that even while the police officer was out of the squad car, she was implicating her sister in the shooting. And that is, I think I have the cite in my brief to the transcript page. But she, after Officer Kemp is in and out of the squad car, but at one point when he's out of the squad car, she says to her sister, they got to get the gunpowder off of her hands, talking about appellant's hands. Then she, appellant, is really in trouble. She didn't have no gloves on. I mean, this is a statement that is not made in the presence of a police officer. It's just made in the squad car. And it plainly implicates her sister. The other indicia of reliability of the statement is that it's close in time. So even though it's my position that the entirety of this statement is not an excited utterance, this court can still consider the proximity of in time of the entire statement to the event when considering its reliability under the residual exception. There's a case in my brief, towards the end of my brief, that cited for that principle. And here, Judge Osby, again, made the observation that the events in time were very close in time, which, again, lends reliability to the squad car statement. I'll move on to sufficiency. Just quickly, I think at page 14 of my brief, I delineate how many times in the squad car that Brianna identifies her sister as the shooter. It's upwards of 10, I think. This is all direct evidence. This is the evidence of an eyewitness testimony whose statement was specifically credited by the district court, who was sitting as fact finder. That statement alone is sufficient evidence to sustain this verdict. And when it's considered with the corroborating evidence, the shell casings, the changing of the T-shirt, the bullet hole riddled car, the circumstances under which the young women were pushing the car, the 911 calls, they all support the statement that her sister was the shooter, but the statement alone is sufficient evidence under this court's law because it's direct evidence. And so there was no waffling. She was certainly naming both Walter and her sister as being involved, but she's quite clear time and time again that Walter was providing the gun and her sister was the shooter. And again, it was specifically credited by the trial court. So I have taken most of my time, but I'm happy to answer whatever questions you have. Otherwise, I would simply ask that you affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Marker. Rebuttal, Ms. Rankin?
Yes.
The video certainly shows that Brianna is angry. And she did testify that she was in the heat of the moment when she was making the statement. But she didn't testify that she was in the heat of the moment of being shot. She didn't say, I was upset about being shot. She just said, well, I guess I was in the heat of the moment. She was in the heat of the moment of being stopped at gunpoint, put in handcuffs, and put in the back of a squad car. The video plainly shows how upset she is about this. That's what spurred this utterance. She also does plainly identify her sister, but she also plainly identifies Walter. There's not enough here to say beyond a reasonable doubt, Breland was the shooter, not Walter. There's just as many, or many references to Walter where they begin by saying Walter had the gun and then edit their statement as they speak.
Do you agree that, I mean, someone can be excited for more than one reason?
Certainly.
Which does seem to exist here. And, I mean, is there any reason that because there are multiple bases for her state that, you know, the excited utterance with respect to this evidence doesn't hold?
I think because her excitement appears to be primarily because of being arrested and then later because of her car being towed, that shows that the statement doesn't have the same kind of reliability that one is looking for with this exception. This exception is looking for someone who's upset and can't possibly fabricate anything about the statement. It's reliable simply because they're still in the heat, they're still worked up about what happened, that they can't lie. But her statement has lies throughout. And that shows that this statement is not that kind of reliable that this exception is looking for. Plantin is also, it does require that the declarant be supportive of the defendant. I would argue that Brianna is not supportive of the defendant at the trial. She was treated as a hostile witness, certainly, and she was being hostile towards the state, but she was being equally hostile towards the defense. The defense asks her point blank, isn't it true you told my investigator that Breland didn't do this? And she says, I don't know, maybe. She's not being helpful at all. If she were being supportive of her sister, she would say, yep, that's exactly true. This never happened. All of her testimony is just agreeing, sort of, or saying, I don't remember, with the defense attorney's questions. She's not actually being helpful to her sister. So Plantin does not support the admission of this statement. I would also note the other evidence, the fourth factor of Orlip is that there must be other evidence that strongly points to the guilt of the accused. By counsel's admission, there is plenty of other evidence, but that in and of itself is not sufficient to show my client's guilt. The other evidence is not strongly indicative of my client's guilt, of the guilt of the accused. It's strongly indicative that there was a shooting, but that's it. And it needs to be strongly indicative of the guilt of the accused to meet that fourth Orlip factor. With regard to the temporal proximity argument, certainly temporal proximity does enhance the reliability of a statement, but it's not the end-all be-all. It's just one of many factors. And here the totality shows that the statement was not reliable, not trustworthy. And Brianna does frequently identify her sister, Breland, as the shooter, but she also frequently talks about Walter having the gun and then backtracks to explain, well, how it could be possible that she had previously identified Breland as well. She does make the statement about the gunshot residue when the officer's not there, but there are also plenty of other self-serving statements made when the officer's not there that appear to be for the benefit of the recording. They're arguing about whether or not Brandy, the co-passenger's true identity is going to come out because she identified herself as a cousin instead of Brandy. And they repeatedly say things that will kind of go back to try to justify why she would be saying those things rather than saying, I'm worrying about my identity being revealed. For instance, there's one instance where she says, I'm worried they're going to pull up Brandy's picture or Talia's picture. She has a gap. But these are my real teeth, or these are fake teeth, though. So she kind of goes back to justify what she's saying on the squad, which shows that they're definitely aware of what's going on with the squad camera and that their statements are not purely for them. I would ask that you go back and watch the video. Brianna's attitude throughout is not upset about the shooting. It's upset about being arrested. It's upset about her car. It's upset about the police. She's not excited about the shooting at all. The statement is not an excited utterance. It doesn't fall under the residual exception either. Her statement does not have the indicia of trustworthiness that come from Orlip and Griffin and the totality of the circumstances. I would ask again that you reverse this matter, remand on the hearsay issue if necessary, but reverse on the sufficiency as well.
Thank you, Ms. Rankin.
Thank you,
Mr. Marker. Matter's been submitted.